Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So in delivering its controversial downgrade of U.S. debt from AAA to AA+, the Standard & Poor's rating agency suggested that Congress and the White House look for at least $4 trillion in deficit reductions over the next 10 years to have a chance to be upgraded again. Well, the government is really only looking for about $1.5 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years. There was a $4 trillion deal on the table, but that broke down in the debt ceiling talks that led to this whole mess. But part of that deal was the creation of a committee of 12, a so-called super committee, 12 members of the House and Senate, six from each party, three from each party in each body. So you got six House members on both sides of the aisle and six senators on both sides of the aisle. They're going to find the $1.2 trillion in cuts over the next or $1.5 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years. And that will prevent automatic triggers from going into effect, which will actually produce automatic cuts in entitlements and other programs, particularly at the Pentagon, likely to be painful enough for the Republicans and Democrats to induce them to find compromise in this super committee. Well, that's the theory anyway. But it's got me worried. That's why we've asked Stephen Smith, professor of political science at the Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, to join us. Steve, good morning to you.
Oh, thank you, John.
You know, I have a little problem of if 535 members of Congress who are impaneled by constitutional authority to deal with these sorts of things can't make a decision, why does, number one, do we think a super committee will do any better? And isn't there some sort of constitutional problem with appointing 12 people to do the job of 535? A little representation issue there?
Well, you're certainly right in thinking that they have their hands full. After all, the top leaders negotiating with the White House over the course of the last 3 or 4 months couldn't come up with an agreement to trim the deficit as deeply as this committee is charged with. So the challenge is huge, and I think most of the serious negotiations, the balance between, say, Medicare and Social Security cuts on the one hand and tax provisions on the other, will really be in the hands of the top party leaders in the White House and really not in the hands of this committee. This committee really can't go beyond much what the top leaders are able to get through the House and the Senate after all. The constitutional question, you know, there's really no problem with the constitutionality of this. Congress is given wide freedom in the Constitution to choose how to organize its internal decision-making processes. They've had joint committees in the past, most famously the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, existed for 30 years after World War II and basically ran domestic nuclear energy policy with members of both the House and the Senate. You know, in the end, this committee's recommendations will come in the form of a bill that has to be passed by the House and the Senate. And so the full constitutional powers of the House and the Senate are preserved.
I see. So as long as both houses vote on whatever the committee produces, it's not really an abrogation of authority. But let's talk a little bit about these automatic trigger mechanisms. I mean, it seems to me there were automatic triggers in the old Graham Rudman sort of budget reduction, Graham Rudman Hollings. Remember, there were formulas and triggers, and you know, how much of a historical precedent is there for using these automatic triggers, and how, you know, how unnerving is that in terms of constitutional authority?
Well, yeah, the Graham-Rudman-Hollings triggers provided that the deficit had to be ratcheted down in 4 steps to get to zero back in the mid-1980s, 1985. And if each step wasn't reached year by year by year, there would be a trigger called sequestration that would cause across-the-board cuts in domestic and defense spending. You know, that never really worked very well. The deficit really was never cut anywhere close to zero. Each year they played some budgetary games so that they could meet the letter of the law without actually shrinking the deficit by the required amount. And they kept adjusting the law and retargeting the process until 1990, when they just gave up on it. So you know, those who were around in those days are a little bit suspicious of any cross-the-board process. I mean, after all, this law that provides for cross-the-board cuts if the committee can't meet its targets can be changed by another law. And so if in the late fall they decide that, you know, they've done the best they can under the circumstances, they can avoid the across-the-board cut simply by passing new legislation. They may end up doing that. The pressure is tighter. There's probably going to be more opposition, especially in the House, doing anything like that. But there's no guarantee here that this whole process will work.
Well, Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis, does that then become an argument for a constitutional amendment, the sort of ultimate automatic trigger for a balanced budget, that it would basically force the Congress to do what it can't decide to do?
Well, it's an argument for it, but the question is whether or not that's a good way to make fiscal policy, either across-the-board cuts or a balanced budget amendment. Now, in the end, they still have to pass the spending and tax bills that accomplish a balanced budget. And having action-forcing devices is fine, but our track record is that they find legal ways to get around them. So what we really need is the political will to get this done. And right now, this committee is being charged with the task that Speaker Boehner, sitting there with President Obama, could not accomplish on their own.
You know,
and it's likely to be kicked up back into their laps, it seems to me, by the time this is over.
You know, the Supreme Court has argued that Congress needs to come up with political will to solve various kinds of issues. I mean, abortion comes to mind. And I'm wondering, you got to figure over that in the Supreme Court, when they see these kinds of automatic triggers and laws that try to get around the political will that you're talking about, that they start sweating a little bit under their robes. What do you figure?
Not really. I think they would give Congress and the president wide discretion in how to use their policymaking authority here. You know, the real problem here is that this joint committee is comprised just of members of Congress. We've had commissions in the past with some outsiders on it, and these outsiders oftentimes brought the political will, appointed by the president from the private sector, unelected officials who had the nerve to suggest serious solutions to policy problems. And we don't have that here. We have the same group that produced stalemate in June and July.
Sad. Stephen Smith, professor of political sciences at Washington University, evaluating the super committee with the long historical view. He spoke to us from Minneapolis. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.